This is Kat Bevington interviewing Jim Atwell on November 13th, 2008 at Mr. Atwell's home.
Would you mind saying your full name for me?
No, it's James Samuel Atwell. That's A-T-W-E-L-L.
Where and when were you born?
I was born on August 17th, 1938. That's A.D., in Annapolis, Maryland, the capital of Maryland, and spent my boyhood there.
What were your parents' names?
My father's name was Tilden O. Atwell, and my mother's name was Catherine Idell Jirashi Atwell.
How do you spell Jirashi?
G-E-R-A-C-I. So I have some Italian in me.
And what were they like?
They were wonderful parents, really. Mother was a very, very ebullient and expressive Irish-Italian woman. And my father, more subdued, but very warm, and just a splendid dad. He was a small-town banker in Annapolis, and known and respected very much in the community. And it always gave me a great pleasure to walk through the town with him, because everyone greeted him, and some people, back in those days, even tipped their hats to him, mind you. So I was always glad to be known as Till Atwell's son.
Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have one older brother by 6 years, and he's named for my father. He's a Tilden, too. it's an odd first name, but the year that my grandfather was born, Samuel Tilden, who was a New York State politician, lost out in the presidential election. And my great-grandfather evidently was so upset by that that he named his son Samuel Tilden Atwell. And so my father got stuck with that as a first name, Tilden, and so did my brother. I was always glad to be the second son and get James instead. But my brother still lives in Annapolis. He's a retired educator, too. Long since retired. He's 75 now.
Would you describe where you grew up for me?
Oh, what an idyllic boyhood. Annapolis at that time was still a sleepy little southern town. The Chesapeake Bay Bridge, which now has two spans near Annapolis, hadn't been built yet. And Route 50, the major route that runs from past Washington, I should say, and across that bridge, had not been built yet. So Annapolis was not yet a bedroom community for Baltimore and Washington, the two big cities closest to it. So it was a quiet little town. The local industry was the United States Naval Academy. That brought the big payroll into the town. It's a little like the Hall of Fame up here. It's the smokeless industry of Annapolis. The only other institution of any real size was St. John's College, an excellent little liberal arts college still there, and the third oldest college in the country, I believe. The town was very quiet. It's located right on an arm of the Chesapeake Bay, and my home was three doors away from the water, a small creek. So for my brother and me, it was fishing and swimming and boating and ice skating in the wintertime, all sorts of good stuff associated with the water. The town was eminently walkable. As I said, everybody seemed to know everybody. In fact, when I first visited Cooperstown with my late first wife, the first thing that struck me was, this is the Annapolis of my boyhood. It felt very, very much like Cooperstown still feels. And what I worry about Cooperstown is it might be going in the direction that Annapolis has long since gone, and sort of lost itself to tourism and to popularity. But who knows? Maybe the economic crisis will save us from that.
We'll see.
Yes, that sends a shiver down your spine, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, if people listen to this tape in 50 years or so, they'll say, what economic crisis? And I'll say to them right now, it was scary.
What were you interested in as a child?
Well, hunting, fishing, a lot. lot of things around the water and around small town life. Wasn't a big player in competitive sports, so I certainly enjoyed them. Had a lot of friends. As a small kid, there were endless games, now long forgotten, that carried us all over the neighborhood. And that was a time, of course, when everybody was surrogate parents to everybody's kids. So if we were running around in somebody else's backyard being too loud at Cowboys and Indians, we would be shouted at. But your mother wouldn't want you behaving like that, and we would be put in our place. That was a very good thing, to have a community raising all the kids. Can't do that in a big city, of course. Happens a little bit here in Fly Creek.
Did you have any hobbies?
I played the piano as a boy, and the organ a little bit later. I started writing early on. When I was 12, I was publishing a neighborhood newspaper. I forget how high the circulation got. We never got into three digits by any means. But that was a lot of fun. And on the basis of that, I guess I got a sense that I liked to write, and I've never stopped since. Carried that right on through all my education, of course, and then always pushed ahead of myself the idea I'd have a time somewhere later in life to do a lot more of this. And I have, since I've retired and been up here, and it's been wonderful. But that's jumping way ahead, sorry.
Oh, no. Do you have any favorite stories from the early newspaper?
Well, let me think. I don't know if we ever published an extra or any... broke any really, really scandalous news in the neighborhood. Mostly it was neighborhood news, who'd been where and who'd visited whom and things of that sort. Poetry by little old ladies who were delighted to have somebody publish it somewhere. So, no, I can't think of anything spectacular. I can just think of the fun it was. And the support I got from my mother, who was very excited about it as a project. And she designed the... masthead for the paper, for instance, and would help me with the little bit of financial dimension of it. At the same time, I was also a newspaper boy for the local paper, delivering the paper at that time 5 times a week. And I guess that was my first experience in the business world, because it really meant keeping accounts and collecting from people once a week. You bought your newspapers from the newspaper office, and then you distributed them, and you had to get your money back from the people, who by and large were very willing to pay you, but sometimes there were people who hid behind their curtains when you came and knocked on the door, or had only a $50 bill and wondered if I had change for it, which is a rotten thing to do to a kid, yeah. I think. And I do remember one disastrous time when my bike, which had in its basket 60 or 70 copies of the newspaper, fell over on its side after I put down the kickstand, and all of the newspapers went into the gutter, which was full of water. So this is a kind of disaster that strikes any businessman, but it hit me early, of course, and cut into my profits for a long, long time. I was weeks recouping from that loss.
What happened with the newspapers? Did you end up delivering any?
No, I had to go back and get a whole fresh set, really, because I couldn't say, here's your paper.
What were your friends like growing up?
Oh, great kids, by and large. I went to a small parochial school, and I think we had only about maybe 30 kids in the class moving along. But we moved along together, so my real base of friendship outside of the neighborhood were these kids that I knew from elementary school right through high school, because I went on into the parochial high school, too. And we were taught by a wonderful order of nuns called the School Sisters of Notre Dame, and they were unlike the nuns you hear in the horror stories of being whacked on the back of hands by rulers. Now, that wasn't their way at all. They were very professional educators, and even the toughest ones, we realized, were out for our good. And I'm grateful to them to this day, really. I think they not only gave me a good education, but they probably aimed me toward a profession in education. because I saw them doing an important job really well, and I thought, you know, this might be a good way to make a living.
What did you want to be, or what did you want to grow up to be as a child?
Oh, well, I don't know, I guess I went through the usual series of things, a fireman, policeman, etc. but as I got on into high school, it really started to focus on two things. One was being a teacher of some sort. And the other was, and this might surprise you, I decided I wanted to be in a Catholic religious order because I was raised as a Catholic. And in fact, that's what happened. I ended up joining the Christian Brothers, which is an order of monks, you'd have to say, who live together in community, take religious vows, of course, wear a religious habit, and run schools, excellent schools, and they still do all over the country. So I was 13 years as a monk, and got pretty much my whole education there, and made a huge new set of friends inside the order, many of whom are my friends to this very day. In fact, tomorrow afternoon, another former monk and his wife are driving all the way from Maine to check in on me and on Anne, because I've got Parkinson's disease now, and it's compromising my life in all sorts of ways. But that's the kind of friends I've carried forward from that day. They stick with you in times like this. He's bringing, he told me on the phone, lobster. And he said, don't worry about supper, we'll make supper when we get there. So that's a good kind of friend to have. Yeah.
Especially bringing a lobster.
Yes, that's okay, isn't it?
let's see. What was it like leaving home for the first time?
Oh, well, that was an interesting experience because I was breaking all sorts of ties going into a monastery, you see. In fact, the place where I was in basic training, I guess you'd say, the novitiate, it's only about 35 miles from home. But, I mean, it was like stepping into another world because life in a religious order at that time really reflected the Middle Ages as much as it reflected the present day, because you had a very organized life. You got up about 5:30 in the morning. You had morning prayers together in the chapel, followed by 45 minutes of silent meditation, followed by Mass, followed by breakfast, followed by a work assignment through the building, because other than the cook, we were all the employees of a very big place. There were 500 acres attached to the novitiate, and some farming still going on there. They were raising pigs, and so I had some hand in that. That was my first experience with pigs, which I carried forward after I moved up here. But it was a rich life, a life of pretty tight discipline, a lot of silence, a lot of meditation. But I've never regretted a moment of those 13 years, because they really set the pattern of my life in so many ways. My educational values as a teacher, my practical approach to teaching. And when I became an administrator, I kept constantly reaching back to the touchstones of the brothers whom I'd seen running excellent schools and thinking, now what would Ignatius have done in this case? You know? And it almost always paid off for me. In many, many administrative meetings, I remember another dean would say to me, how do you think of that? And I'd say, well, I didn't think of that. That was thought of in the 17th century by one of the early Christian brothers. So that was a rich time in my life. And I guess I've described three sets of friends to you now, the neighborhood friends and the school friends and the friends through the brothers. A lot of them are still close friends to mine. Some of them are dying off now, and that's a bittersweet business to realize. We're all moved into the age where your friends start to thin out on you. But I'm grateful for them, very grateful.
After being a monk, how did you decide where to go?
Well, that was another big decision. That was like a leaving home a second time. Because by then, you know, I was so very comfortable in that way of life. And I decided that the best thing to do would be to return to Annapolis, home base there. My mother was dead by that time. My father was living alone as a widower, and I thought, well, He'll give me house room for a while till I get on my feet. And when I applied for a job at a community college quite close to Annapolis and got it in English and also in teaching comparative religion, as it turned out. I got just about all my education beyond high school while I was a brother. So I got a degree in undergraduate degree in English language and literature, and then a master's degree from the University of Maryland in English language and literature, and while still in the brothers, I got a master's in theology from LaSalle University in Philadelphia. And then it was after I left the brothers and after I was married, I carried through a doctorate at Catholic University in Washington. But again, I'm very grateful to the brothers for that wonderful educational tradition, because their basic stance was if you've got the wits to do it and the determination to do it, go ahead. Go ahead, get as much education as you can. So that was a value I carried forward too. So I slipped very easily into community college life there. It's another kind of institutional life when you think about it, a faculty life. And that very first year met my wife-to-be. In fact, we were slammed together by the campus matchmaker, an Italian woman professor in her then, I guess, her 50s, who walked into my office the first day of orientation, mind you, and introduced herself to me and said, "Are you married?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And she said, "I've got a wonderful girl I want you to meet." Now, mind you, she had just been down the hall and introduced herself to Gwen, my first wife. Never seen her before. But she literally took me by the arm, walked me down the hall. Now, here I am, mind you, 2 months out of the monastery, not very well equipped for your ordinary social life. And she literally put us in one another's company and said, "This is Gwen, and this is Jim, Gwen." And she stood there while we had a very awkward conversation. And then she looked at me and said, "Well, aren't you going to ask her out for a date?" Wait a minute, this is moving a little fast. Well, we did go out on a couple of dates, but she had, Rose, her name was, she had slammed us together so much we sort of ricocheted. And it took us almost another year to find our way back to one another and to realize, well, we were a good match. So we carried on our life and our marriage at the college there and living fairly close by. And sadly had a whole set of really sad miscarriages and realized that raising a family wasn't to be and that perhaps we should concentrate on doing our parenting through our students, which we did, and we had a wonderfully rich life there together. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 1987. I went through some awful surgeries, but that stuff's a death sentence from the beginning, really. And she finally died of it in early 1989, having held on much longer than most pancreatic cancer patients do, but she was a strong and a determined woman, and a blessing to me. And we had another blessing, that hospice helping us out, so she was able to die at home. And the president of the college at that time, a big, bluff Italian named Tom Florestano, was never more at his best than when there was trouble in the college family of this sort. At that time, I was a dean of arts and sciences, reporting directly to him. So he called me into the office as things were getting worse with Gwen and said, "Look, I have a new assignment for you. You are to go home and take care of Gwen. And don't come up here unless to the campus unless you need to. I'll appoint an acting dean." And he did, and my salary continued, and Gwen's salary continued. Honestly, I'll be eternally grateful to him and to the board of trustees of that college, because they enabled her to die at home and me to care for her and have her in my arms when she actually died. And I can't tell you my gratitude for that. So after her death, after Gwen's death, I stayed at the college. I ended up being vice president for academic affairs. That was about 2 years, I guess, after his death. But I started really to feel that if I didn't make some kind of change in my life, I was just going to idle in neutral the rest of my days. The academic life had just become empty for me because it was so much associated with her, you see. And the college was almost haunted by her for me. So I decided I would take early retirement, and did. And let's see, that would have been 1992. I took early retirement. And as you've read in the book, about midway through our marriage, Gwen, who brought me up here regularly because she grew up in Edmiston, just over the hills here, she and I decided we wanted to retire up here eventually because we both loved the area so. So we watched the local newspapers and we saw this place come up for sale, a very old, very primitive farmhouse at that time with about 10 acres attached. And we decided, that's it, we'll buy it, and we did. 1977 or so, and had tenants in the house for, 10 years and better, most of them residents from Bassett. And they were the perfect tenants because they were rarely at home, and when they came home, they just crashed. They were so exhausted. So they treated the house very well. And they were satisfied with pretty primitive arrangements because at that time there was no central heating in the house. There was just a big kerosene stove that sat right out there in the living room. And that supposedly radiated heat to the whole house, but not very effectively. And the electrical service was poor in it, and the plumbing service was poor. And as you'll remember from the book, what we did was keep the second floor of the barn, which you can see out that window, I think, the red building there. We kept that as our pied-à-terre up here and built a kind of camp up there and would come up here as often as we could to enjoy this wonderful area. Well, after Glenn's death and after those 2 years of rattling around in the college, I decided that's where I'm going. It made no sense in a lot of ways to walk away from a very secure job in respect to my colleagues and my own parking place and all that crap, if you'll excuse me, and to move to the country, because I never lived in the country except during my training when I helped tend the pigs back in the division. But everything inside of me said, go north. Not young man, but the late middle-aged man. Go north. And I did, and it was a marvelous decision. I've never felt so rooted as I do in this little community and in this beautiful area. My friends thought I was crazy, but sort of humored me in it. And a lot of them came up to visit over the next few years and said, oh, I see why you wanted to come up here, because it is a beguiling, charming area, isn't it? I moved up here with the idea that I was going to live in this house as a kind of hermit, and that I'd gradually become the odd old man at the end of Cemetery Road, and that I'd be found lying dead in the living room some weeks after my death, and they'd roll me up in the carpet and bury me in the Fly Creek Cemetery. Well, that didn't happen, fortunately, because, as you know from the book, not long before I left Annapolis, within months, I met Anne through the Rotary Club down there, ringing the bell for the Salvation Army. And we struck it off immediately. She grew up in Calgary, Alberta, so there was nothing daunting about the weather up here to her, just like you from Minnesota. So we started visiting back and forth, and it took us about 3 years, I guess, to really get to the point where we, as you saw from the book, where we went to that meeting of the... And I realized that she had perfect hands for delivering lamps. But there was a lot more to it than that. So we've been very, very happy together. We complement each other extremely well, I think. when I got this diagnosis of Parkinson's, for instance, we spent a lot of time crying together over it, you know, sitting on this sofa, and I remember saying to her one day, I don't want to ruin your life, because this disease is going to not only define my life the rest of my life, but Anne's the rest of my life, too. So I said, I don't want to ruin your life. And she said, like that, you are my life. Whoa! I've been living on that ever since, really. Just that beautiful, simple statement. And everything she's done since there has demonstrated that. She will not allow me to call her my caregiver. She says she's my care partner. And she is indeed. She's like a coach. She won't cut me any slack I don't deserve. Insists that I carry on as best I can for as long as I can, which is what I want to do. But how wonderful to have somebody saying, you go, guy, you go, you go. So that's a terrific blessing. But I'm ahead of the story, aren't I? Where was your last question?
You don't have to go by the questions. They're just kind of more guidelines.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
Let's see. How have you been coping with Parkinson's?
Well, I think pretty well. We have an unbelievably valuable asset in Bassett, right here in town. Terrific staff. And I think people who complain about it, about its size and impersonality, are older people from around here who remember it as a much smaller place, but don't realize what a richness it is now and its potential of serving the whole community. So I've had the advantage not only of a tremendous and effective general practitioner, Doug DeLong, but he forwarded me on to Paul Derringer, who is a neurologist, who lives right here in Fly Creek, by coincidence. And Paul has been just spectacular and is taking care of not only me, but Anne. Anne will often come to the appointments because Paul wants to hear her perspective on how this thing is moving forward in me. And that's a great value. And then with Paul's encouragement, we went down to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, to one of the three best centers for Parkinson's in the country, and talked to one of the really big dogs down there. And at our end of our consultancy session, he said, well, you are in the best of hands up there in Cooperstown. If you had come to me first, I would have done exactly what Dr. Derringer has done, given you exactly the same medication. So we came home wonderfully comforted by that, and with the sense we've got this team behind us, plus the fact I've drawn on the physical therapy program through Bassett and on their speech therapy program, because one of the problems with Parkinson's is that without your realizing it, your voice starts to soften. You're not projecting the way you think you are. And it can become slurred and atrophied in time. Well, there's a young man at Bassett named David White, who is the one-man speech therapy department there, who took me in hand. He's much older than you, I guess. I guess he might be in his 30s. But David said, you did exactly the right thing coming here early on in this, because often when people come to me, he said, it's almost too late. The damage has been done. Their vocal cords have gone slack on them a bit. But he said, we can fix this. And he did. I mean, what he'd started with was sitting down with a little meter that read decibels of production. And he said, all right, we're going to start in ordinary conversational tone, and you're going to match your volume to mine. So we did, and I thought I was doing fine. He said, all right, now we're going to talk as if we were in a classroom, and we're projecting toward the back, and our voices went up accordingly. Now we're in a big auditorium, he said. And you want to be sure everyone can hear you. I brought my voice. Now we're standing in a field yelling. I don't know what people in the hall were thinking about this. But what he did at every stage was to point at this meter, and at every stage I was 10 decibels below him, though I thought I was matching him in volume every time. So what I have lost, and what most Parkinsonians lose, is that discriminatory ability that applies not only that, but to your walking. I was taking much shorter steps than I thought I was taking. And it turns out that the basic cause of Parkinson's is a terrific reduction in a particular sort of neurotransmitter produced way down in your primitive brain, right down the head of your spinal column, your reptile brain, as they call it. And it's the one that governs a great many of the habits you began to pick up as an infant, really. It governed your being able to crawl initially, and to stand, and to walk, and eventually to speak. It governs your fine motor skills in your hands. It functions as a kind of brake, control, a governor controlling your motion. And that's why tremors are such a noticeable part of Parkinson's. I'm doing pretty well today, by the way, with the tremors, because it varies from day to day. Often I'd be sitting here with at least this hand going like this, and sometimes both, and sometimes my legs in motion too, so that's not much fun, I must say. Medication helps. Anyway, this David White trained me to use my voice not as at the volume I thought it should be, but at a louder voice. I feel like I'm shouting at you right now, but I hope I'm not.
Nope.
Good.
You're good.
That it's worked, you see, because I feel like this is much too loud a voice for this conversational setting, but I now know that I can't trust my own judgment on that. The other things that have to be coped with is that all of these semi-automatic habits that you've developed from childhood are compromised. Walking becomes, it has to be a conscious experience now. And I can't multiple task at all. As Anne says, I'm not safe to eat a cookie and walk along a sidewalk at the same time, because I fell off the sidewalk doing that once, and she saw it, and that's become her great example. So bless her heart. I hope you get to meet her sometime. She's a wonderful woman. So life becomes a pattern of single tasking. When I'm driving, I've got to be driving and nothing else. When I'm tending the animals, I've got to be tending the animals and nothing else. If random thoughts draw me away from it, or if I say, oh, here's something that needs to be done in the barn, I'm most likely to wander back to the house with the job half done for the animals, or a gate left over, or worse. So it's a very different pattern. Simply, what it means is what used to be under automatic pilot down here has to be moved forward into your conscious brain. And that's exhausting. It really is, to hold yourself on target that way, constantly. You may know that sad progress of this disease. There's no cure for it, of course. I was watching Michael Fox on television yesterday, and he's 14 years into this or so. Got it as a very young man. And you can see the tremors, even under medication, all through his shoulders and his arms. And he's still wonderfully good-humored, and he jokes away a lot of it, but he's got it good. And from inside me, I look at him and I say, yeah, I can see it, buddy. But I can also see myself, you know, my own future. And that's a little demanding sometimes, too. What else? I think that the biggest challenge is that living exactly in what you're doing at any given moment. Although most spiritual writers would say that's the way we ought to all live. We ought to live in the presence. And that's true, but I don't think they mean it exactly this way. Is that enough on that? I don't want to...
Oh, that's great.
...burden you with all that stuff.
Oh, no. As much as you want to talk about.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Well, they're very good signs on research in Parkinson's now. And Michael J. Fox has been a tremendous force in this. He has a big foundation. And because he is such a beloved actor, you must have seen him in lots of movies. If you see him in what was one of his last, where he plays a Hollywood doc, is that what it's called? He's a doctor who gets, his car breaks down in the rural South. He ends up trapped there for a few weeks, and it's a life-changing experience, and he falls in love. It's a rather slight picture. I think that Back to the Future was better. But anyway, when I watch that movie and look closely at him, I can see the Parkinson's in him, because you can see his tremors in his left hand, and you can see him keeping a finger in a pocket like this during the scenes of the movie, or hooked in his belt, or behind his back, and I think, I know what you're doing. Exactly, you're trying to hide that tremor. And indeed, in his book, he talks about finishing a scene in his later movies and just going into his trailer and lying on the floor in a kind of fetal position, shaking violently, waiting for his medication to take effect, and then he'd get up and he'd go out and do another scene. Well, I don't have to worry about movie making, but... Anyway, that's what's sort of defining my life now, except for another very, very important part. As you would suspect from my having become a monk early on, spiritual pilgrimage is very, very fundamental to my life. And for the last 35 years, I've been a Quaker, and have found a very comfortable spiritual home there. The brothers started me out in meditation, of course, every day, and it was a very natural transition to the silent worship of the Quakers. So I meet with Quakers here in Cooperstown, just a group of 10 or 12 every Sunday. And I've also become what the Quakers call a recorded minister, which means I'm sort of a Quaker with portfolio to speak in other churches and to do counseling work and writing and all sorts of stuff like that. Perform weddings, funerals, and I do a great deal of that. And that's tremendously enriching to me to still be able to use those abilities in other people's pulpits. For instance, I spoke at the Presbyterian Church 2 Sundays ago. And I love doing marriages. Oh, gosh, that is just such a joy. And I pick and choose very carefully and talk to the couple ahead of time. And if I sense that all they really want is somebody to perform a ceremony for them, somebody they need the way they need candles and flowers and music and so forth, then I say, thanks, I'm not the man you want. But if I sense that this is a couple who's really on their own spiritual pilgrimage, and that they want their vows to be something far more than a civil contract, then bingo, that's where I belong, helping them out. And often they won't be associated with a particular church, and somehow they find their way to me. And if I sense that they are really serious, then I'm delighted to have a part in it. And so far, they've all lasted. Not one of them has broken up. They've chosen one another very well, and maybe I've been careful in my choosing, too. And the funerals, well, that's a wonderful thing to do, too, because having been through the awful grief of losing Gwen, I'm left with a sense of empathy, very readily, especially for husbands who've lost wives. I can remember after Gwen's death, men coming up to me and saying, I know how you must feel. And I'd say to myself, oh, the hell you do. You can't begin to know how I feel. But if another man came up and put a hand on my shoulder and said, I lost my wife too. Whoa. That was like a bomb being poured on a burn, really. And that's what I've tried to do ever since. I think we're given gifts of that sort at the price of our own suffering sometimes. But it's a precious gift, and it's useful to other people. I can see it. And I guess one of the sadnesses of looking toward the future is the time's going to come when I'm not going to be able to climb in somebody else's pulpit, or when my voice will have gone to the point where it can't be pulled back. And I said this to a man who's the general secretary of Quakers for all of New York State. He called up to see how I was doing. I said, "Christopher, I dread the time when I won't be able to be of active service to anyone." And he paused and said, "Jim, that's when yours will become a ministry of receiving rather than giving." That astounded me. And I've lived on that particular sentence ever since, because, as he went on to say, there can't be givers if there are not receivers. And this is the great economy of human life. This gives meaning to suffering and to limitation, because it can draw forth from others this wonderful richness of giving. Now, it's a very humbling sort of ministry when you think about it, if you're to the point where you can't do very much at all for yourself, perhaps even speak clearly anymore, perhaps even think clearly anymore, and people have to tend to you, but you are a source of grace for them. You are the one to whom their gifts are given. And we all end up pretty much in that position. What happens with Parkinson's is it speeds the whole process up, really. A lot of the symptoms that I feel, and here goes a little bit of one of them right now, a lot of the symptoms that I feel are things that will come upon us anyway if we live to be 95 or 100 or 105. It's just with Parkinson's. So in the case of Michael J. Fox, it can start much, much earlier. He was 37 or so, I think, when this struck him. Oh, we're back on Parkinson's again. But it is a big part of my life just now, as you might imagine. And another great circle of friends for me are the Quakers. And not just the Quakers, but the church communities of this area, whom I've met through this broader work of speaking in. Last night, the Presbyterians invited me to their annual turkey dinner, which was just great. I'm not a member of their congregation, but I'm in and out of there speaking a couple of times a year at least, and more frequently now because they're without a pastor just now. So I walked in there and people welcomed me as if I were a member of the group. And I see a terrific richness in kind of helping stitch the Christian community more tightly together, because it's a scandal that we have all these different denominations. My word. So maybe that's a useful thing that I get to do too. And I hope it continues for a while anyway. Well, what else now? I'm just wandering on here. Not...
Oh, no, that's perfect.
I'd like to say something at some point about what I treasure about living in this kind of environment. Do we have to do videotaping too? I didn't ask you.
Oh, no, just the recording.
Okay, great. All right. How to start this. If you think of this area, 200 years ago, especially in the wintertime, what you see is the same beautiful terrain, but tiny villages and hamlets nestled usually near a creek or a river, largely isolated from one another through the wintertime. The basic communication among them was maybe local newspapers, which got delivered every so often, and the mail, which got through, and then traveling salesmen who moved from town to town and from the Toddsville Hotel to the Fly Creek Hotel to a hotel in Cooperstown and then down to Dover, taking orders for goods that would later be delivered. And they had often as not brought the news of what was going on and the gossip. But by and large, every one of those little communities for a great part of the year were sealed off for one another. And so each one of them had to have all its own essential services. As they grew, that was certainly the case with Fly Creek, which developed its own fire department, and it had a barber here, it even had a doctor here, it even had a little newspaper for a while. It had a couple of millinery shops making hats for the ladies, it had dry goods stores, two or three than it is right now, about, though it's never been much larger than it is right now, about 350 to 400 people. It's just that you couldn't go elsewhere to get your goods. You had to get them right at home. And what that makes for is a tremendous sense of community, of interdependence. Because as those people move from this store to that, to the barbershop, to the four or five churches that were here at one time, it was they were sewing this little community closer together, you see, by that sort of interaction. And so you had not only interdependence, but I think a real sense of community. And we look back on that as a beautiful thing now lost. Well, it's not completely lost by any means. Certainly it's lost in cities. But in a place like Fly Creek or even Cooperstown, it still lives. What's been the death of a lot of it is the automobile, of course, and ease of transportation. And mass communications, where suddenly you're a citizen of the world these days. And if you want to buy something, you can get it cheaper at Walmart. And as soon as that attitude starts to develop, and long before Walmart it was already developing, the local stores start to die. So we're down to one general store in Fly Creek now, one church in Fly Creek. The Grange building with the Historical Society is still there. But you really have to work at community these days. We're lucky because we still have the core of a business community out here in Fly Creek. We've got our restaurant back open again, Harmony House down here on the corner. Plus we have Portobello's, a really nice restaurant, and the General Store, which is the hub of Fly Creek. I was up there this morning because of the paper, the Cooperstown Crier, comes out on Thursday. So it's been my ritual for 15 years at least, to go up there on Thursday morning and to read my column to see if it makes any sense after the fact or how many typos I've gotten into it. And I go in there and invariably people come in who have already read the column that morning because it was delivered at home, and they'll walk up to my table and say either, "Well, what the hell were you trying to say in that column?" Or they'll say, "You know, what you said there reminded me of something my grandfather used to talk about." And bang, I've got another column just like that, you know. That's where a tremendous amount of the material comes to me in my office up at the General Store, which is a corner table up there. And I think if my column has a value, and you're obliged to read it every week now, of course.
Yes.
If it has a value, it is doing the kind of stitching I was just talking about. For lack of the living institutions that used to pull us together because we were an interdependent community, we have to very deliberately create substitutes. The Historical Society out here does that very, very well. A very active little church out here still does it well. The fire department does it very, very well. And for the broader area, I think my column makes that kind of contribution because people read it, they talk about it, they argue about it, and that's fine. That is stitching going on, pulling a community together. And of course, that's something the graduate program is very, very interested in, community and how it's promoted and how it's sustained. So I hope I am making a contribution to that. And then the book, which is an outgrowth of the columns, of course, has sold very well. And I think because those themes are very universal, the theme of community, and people hunger for it. I mean, people in cities who bought this book have written to me or emailed me and said, "You know, this is great. This reminds me of my neighborhood when I was growing up. Or I wish I could live in a place like Fly Creek." So that's a good thing, I think. So those values, the values of interdependence and of community, I think live in a more real way in a place like this than they do most places in the world. And one real symbol of that, easily overlooked, I think, is the way we wave to one another when we drive. Have you noticed this? I mean, people always say, yeah. And I think what's going on there, especially a little more out in the country here from the big city of Cooperstown there, is this is an expression of a contract among us, a covenant. This says, if I get in trouble, you'll help me. If you get in trouble, I'll help you. You run off the road, I'll stop and help. I run off the road, you stop and help. Okay? Okay. I think that's what's being said through those gestures. And it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Just beautiful. So that's why I love living here. That's why I feel more rooted here than I have in any of the other places I've lived across a kind of checkered lifetime, really. So, where should we go now?
Let's see.
Any cleanup questions there?
Oh, I don't think so.
Really? How fine.
You actually went pretty much through all of my questions.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, as I say, I've done this sort of thing before. I've spent a lot of time talking in my life. And that, to finish on a slightly gray note, I guess, that's what I dread most of all about this Parkinson's, that it begins really to affect my mind. And it's going to, sooner or later. And probably is already. I'm going through a battery of tests right now, 3 2-hour sessions of either neuropsychological or psychoneurological tests to see whether my powers of cognition are being affected. And as the person taking the tests, I can see they have been already. For instance, I can't do the simplest of word problems in my head anymore. If it's a word problem that has three terms, you have to, you know, do something with A and B and then relate that to C. By the time I've turned from B towards C, I've lost A completely. And you know, it's almost a feeling of panic. The simple stuff, I just can't do that in here anymore. Mathematics, I can't add in my head, as I used to be able to, two-column addition. Because I lose the terms. And if I get to the end of the first column and get ready to carry over, I've lost what I've added up to in the first column already, like that. Oh. So that's reason of concern. And active vocabulary. You know, I've always been a kind of fossil speaker with a pretty big active vocabulary, but I grope for words much more than I used to. And in my own speech, I hear pauses in sentences like that one that didn't used to be there at all. So things are changing, and that scares me because this is who I am, of course. I've lived in this head all my life, and I've dealt with the world through talking to myself, which of course is what thought is, and then through talking with others and writing and through communication. And the idea that the wires are starting to go down, That's scary. But maybe they'll last for a while longer anyway. I think so, because I'm still in pretty good shape and I was able to talk to you fairly effectively this morning, I hope.
Very well.
Good. Well, thank you for reassuring me.
Yes.
And then here's something very interesting. I mentioned that out of the grief of that was mine after Gwen's death, came this capacity to help other people with grief. Something similar is happening with the Parkinson's now. I've been writing about this in my column about every 2 months or so, 3 months, just telling people what it feels like from the inside. Well, on that basis, I've had contact from a lot of people around here who have Parkinson's, many of whom, especially men, who've retreated into their homes reclusively because they don't want to be seen shaking or, you know, spilling coffee in a restaurant or something like that. And so they've become almost hermit life in their own, like in their own homes. And I think I've probably provided a kind of point of focus for them that may draw them forth into at least a support group of some sort. And I hope that's going to happen. Now, that's a byproduct of my situation now. But as a person who thinks of himself on spiritual pilgrimage, I have to look at this disease as not some predator that's pounced on me, but as a redirection of my life by God, by a loving Father. And if that's the case, I should accept it as a gift and a redirection and look for the ways I'm now supposed to serve through it. And I think I've just described one of the ways, these people coming out of the closet with their Parkinson's to some extent. That'll be a very good thing if I can help with that for as long as I can. So there's an upbeat note to end on. Unless you've got more.
Oh, yes. let's see. Well, actually, walking in here, I could hear, I think it was a rooster.
Oh, yes.
Crowing a bit.
Yep.
How did you discover your love of animals?
Oh, gosh. Well, there were always dogs and cats around through my childhood. My first experience with farm animals was when I was in training to be a Christian brother, as I say. Lots of animals there. And when I moved up here, I guess my initial thought was, well, I'll have some chickens for sure. But sheep, I thought the sheep would be a very nice thing to raise. And my initial plan was just to get a couple of sheep and raise them up through the summer and into the fall. But Ari Hecox, who you remember from that book, would have no part of that. He took me in hand. He said, no, you can't raise sheep unless you get yourself a ewe and get her bred and birth out lambs. And before I knew it, he had me off to the livestock auction, and back we came with, I think, two ewes initially. And he just took a real delight in watching my blundering into farming, and he kept pushing me farther. What a great old guy he was. He was a second father to me, without question. They say that men are always looking for additional fathers, and Ari was perfect for that. And I was perfect for him because he was a relatively new widower himself at that point. His Lillian, who was a dear woman, had died, and he was alone down there with just a big old collie, his company. So he just took me on as a project and as a kind of son. He died sitting next to me in the car, in my car. This will be in the next book, not this one. But he had he lived right down the road here, not a mile from here. But his own health had failed to the point that for the winter he had moved into Cooperstown to his grandson's home on the corner of Elm and Susquehanna. And it was on toward May. It was right after Easter, in fact, when I got a phone call from him. And he said, Jim, come in here and take me to the hospital. And I thought, oh, Lord. He hated hospitals. I couldn't imagine how bad things were if he wanted to go. So when I got there, they were awful. He was in the last stages of congestive heart failure. I mean, every breath was a gurgle. I mean, there was that much fluid in his lungs. So I said, I'm calling 911. And he said, nope, you can get me there faster. And he grabbed his hat, put it on his head, dragged himself out of his chair, and he was in my car before I knew it. So I said, okay. So I got in the car, and it was only blocks from Bassett, maybe 10 blocks. So I got down Susquehanna, I turned onto Elm, started down Elm, And the next to last thing he said in his life was one more jab at my driving, which he loved to do. He said, "Slow down, you're going to kill me." Ironic. We got to pass it, and we pulled up outside of the emergency room and stopped. He said, "Well, there, that's better." And that was the last thing he said. And I glanced at him, and I could see he was just slipping away right then. So I managed to say, "Thank God. I love you, old man. And I hope that's the last thing he heard." Because by the time I got in and they came out with a gurney, he was gone. What a great guy. Yeah, I'll have to put that in the next book, if there's a next book.
How did you decide to write your first book?
Well, let me see. People kept asking for it. People kept saying, "I'm clipping your columns every week and I send them all over the place to people. Why don't you put them in a book?" So I talked it out with Ann, and you know, I've done about 800 of these columns by now, if you can imagine, 800. So it wasn't hard to go into my file, to the early part of it, and to pull out the ones that really described my move through widowhood up here and getting a new life, starting first through the community and through farming and then through Ann. So it all fit together very nicely. And then Ann, who's just a wonderful artist, this is some of her work right up here. That's,
oh, wow.
That's pencil work, mind you. She's just terrific. Go back home and look at your book and look at those illustrations closely. You'll see how good she is. She said, "Well, you know, I can illustrate it." So it became a mutual project from that point on, and we moved into it very warily because we didn't know what it would do to our marriage, really, doing this professional work together. Well, it was fine, because she had this whole set of professional skills that I didn't have, and I had a whole set that she didn't use with any kind of regularity. So I put the book together, she did the illustrations. Every now and then she would say to me, "Get the camera, you've got to go get me a picture of a pig, face on." And I would say, "Okay." Well, we weren't raising pigs at that point, so I'd rush over to the Farmer's Museum and catch a picture of a pig looking at me, bring it back, and then she would base an illustration on that because she wanted to get the expression. And if you look at the picture in there of Cholesterella, my favorite pig, her face really is on the basis of one of the pictures because Cholesterella had long since passed through the freezer by that time. So it became fun. And then there were parts of her trade that I'd never understood. So we would sit in front of the computer screen, and she did all of the, not only the choice of typeface, but setting up the entire book, including designing the cover and the back and everything. And what she did was send all this to the publisher, who sent it right on to the printer, practically. So she did a camera-ready copy. In fact, the way that happened was, I'd struck a deal with the publisher for their, this is North Country Books up in Utica, for publishing it, and then I wanted to take up some sample chapters to them, and Ann had set them up in type and put in a couple of illustrations. I think one of them was the one with Owen the cat sort of walking down the page through the type. Well, the owner, editor up there looked at this thing and said, "My God, she knows what she's doing, doesn't she?" And I said, "She sure does." Well, it ended up they hired us both, you see. And they gave us 10% royalty, which was high for a first book, because essentially they were getting all her magnificent work as a part of the package. It really simplified their job for them. But we would sit in front of her computer screen over there looking at the text, and she would spot what in that trade they call rivers. And that is, she'd look at the page, not at the words, at the page, and see that the spacings between words and sentences was creating a kind of very distracting open pattern down the page. I would never have thought of that. But the graphic designers do it, and the publishers. And if you look at a book and see that, you'll say, ah, somebody skipped an important job here. And in a well-done book, you never see that. But now you see what that meant was, we'd have to make changes in my prose to get rid of the rivers. And, you know, for most writers, that's like cutting into your own flesh. No, you can't change a thing here. No, I need that preposition. Well, very quickly, I moved into teamship with her and said, okay, now how can we fix this? How about if we move this prepositional phrase up here? That'll do it. Look, the river's gone.